Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, we'll begin. Is the loudspeaker working? You hear? All right, good. Welcome to this session on the Mormons as their neighbors see them. I recall the story my mother often told and delighted in telling of our great-grandmother Jean Mather, who prepared with her family to depart for the West during the period of the Mormon Exodus. But a neighbor came and persuaded her father, sat all night with him on the tongue of a wagon, persuaded him not to go. And so that great-grandmother went alone. She was something of a heroine in the family. She chose to go and become a Mormon. But I often think, what happened to those relatives of mine who didn't go and become Latter-day Saints? Our Latter-day Saints are a very ethnocentric people, and that's proper and good in many ways. But often I think they ignore a good deal of reality because of their ethnocentricity. And I think of all those good people I'm related to, if not by genes and blood, then by spirit and emotion, who have not been Latter-day Saints. And so it is my pleasure to chair a session in which three persons who are not Latter-day Saints, but who have lived among them many, many years, have been friendly with them, have many friends among them, have many good insights into them, have agreed to come and speak with a spirit of tactful frankness to us about how they view the Latter-day Saints. I will introduce each one as it is that person's turn. So I will first introduce Mary Harrington, and then she will read her remarks to you, and then I will introduce the others in that fashion. I think we will be through with plenty of time for your questions, and they would be welcome at the end of the session. Mary Harrington is a native of Oak Park, Illinois. She holds a master's degree in the sociology of religion and Christian ethics from the University of Chicago. She is married to a university history professor. She has written articles extensively, had them published in religious journals, mostly Protestant journals, though not entirely. She's an active member in the United Church of Christ, in which she has held numerous offices. In 1987, she was awarded the National Celebration of the Gifts of Laywomen Award from the Biennial General Synod, United Church of Christ in Cleveland, Ohio. She has two sons, the youngest converted to Mormonism and has filled an LDS mission. And her paper will be, "Not Every Family Rejoices to Have a Child Go on a Mormon Mission." So, Mary, please.
My essay is really very personal and sensitive, showing how it happened and the pain of both our Protestant-raised son, Jack, and our mainline Protestant family when he converted to Mormonism and subsequently did go on a mission. And I've thought several times that I back out and not do it at all, but Dr. Peterson said, go ahead, because we hope such an essay might spread some ecumenical understanding. And I believe that this Sunstone group is well aware, though Mormons and mainline Protestants use very similar terminology. You know, we talk about bringing people to Christ and many other terms. I think you're all aware that these meanings are different. And this isn't a theological paper, so I'm not going to discuss any of these meanings It's just a presupposition that you know that the two religions are indeed different, despite the fact that many, many terms and many things about them are similar. Okay, to hear, is this going down a little lower, huh? Okay. To hear some Mormons talk, one would assume that every family rejoices to have a child go on a Mormon mission. A recently published article about the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints relates the utter delight of family and friends when a person receives a mission call. We are a mainline Protestant family, totally committed and active in our church at many levels, and we are not elated to have our son on a Mormon mission. When we tell our Protestant and Catholic friends, they say, "Incredible, we're so sorry." Mormons interested in reaching out to the world need to realize that there are other deeply religious, active church people with sincere and valid beliefs beside themselves. Certainly, such people do not rejoice to have a child join the Mormon church and go on a mission. I cite our family as an example. Differences between the faiths, Mormon and mainline Christian, should be recognized. Mormons believe, oftentimes, that drinking coffee is a sin which forbids their entrance into their temple. But it seems to me that some of them appear to find that manipulating the truth is justified if this is a means toward the great end of conversion. Most Protestants and Catholics drink coffee as they choose, but agree that telling untruths for any reason forfeits their opportunity for salvation. And this difference is poignant in our own story. Our friendly hazel-eyed son Jack participated for 20 years with his brother and parents in a Utah mainline Protestant church. He attended Sunday school regularly, completed confirmation classes, and fellowship with the youth group. As early as the third grade, Jack frequently made presentations in the pulpit during the worship service on historical subjects, which he loved. First, he stood on a stool to reach the podium, speaking in a high, clear voice with his blonde hair bobbing over his paper. Later, he towered above the pulpit, forcefully enunciating his reports with expressive gestures and a wide smile. Our church family followed his progress joyfully. Jack wanted friends. As a child, he conversed well with adults, but had some problems making friends of his own age. Therefore, when he began to pal around at the public high school with pleasant Mormon youth, we encouraged it. We became friendly with their families, and we still are. We were proud when he became a major school leader, mainly among Mormons. As a non-Mormon president of the city PTA, and the only such person on the state board at that time, I got along well with Mormons without being influenced by their faith. So it was with my professor husband, a teacher and scholar, highly regarded by colleagues, students, and the general community. We assumed it would be the case with our two sons. Then Jack began to wonder, "Can I keep my friends since I'm not a Mormon? If I don't join the Mormon church, will they still be my friends? I should have emphasized why would you want them otherwise?" Sometimes I accompanied him to farewell services for schoolmates leaving for Mormon missions at age 19. I considered such attendance the same as going to someone's wedding at their church. When people asked, "Would you like to study our religion?" I politely said, "Thank you, but we're completely committed to our own church." The Mormons my husband and I met seemed to accept us as Protestants and refrained from proselytizing. Not so with Jack. In his desire for friends, which our small congregation couldn't provide, he was vulnerable. To Mormons, he was teachable at a teachable moment in his life. Perhaps I erred in not explaining our faith as well as I might have. His brother Ed, 2 years older, made friends at the Catholic school, which we had wanted Jack to attend, but he didn't choose it. Then Ed went away to a private college. Jack also received scholarships to several colleges, but when he decided to attend our local public university, we didn't interfere. My husband was a full professor at this university, and I a community activist and writer, and we participated in a variety of activities with our outgoing son. Although Jack enjoyed helping us host college and church gatherings, we noticed that his social life began to center at the Mormon Institute. Then we discovered he was taking Mormon Institute courses, although he didn't tell us about this development. As a sophomore, Jack needed new contacts. We encouraged him to study in Spain for a quarter with a group from our school. He lived with a Spanish family, meeting Spanish Catholics and Protestants. Jack wrote us enthusiastically about his Spanish studies, his host family, and sightseeing. He didn't mention that all the young people from our university were Mormon, and he was spending his time with them. Instead of investigating ancient cathedrals, he attended Mormon services in a small ward. Meeting a former schoolmate, now a missionary to Spain, in the massive crowd of the Good Friday Holy Procession, Jack felt the Mormon Church was calling him. The students told him they were happy and close because they were all Mormons, and he longed for such friendship himself. As the group traveled by bus through Spain after finishing their courses, Jack thought it God's will that missionaries greeted him at every stop. Later, the students admitted they telephoned missionaries in each area to meet him. He began taking in the faith. When he returned to the States, Jack purposely neglected to tell us about the Mormon influence he'd been under. In 6 weeks, he wrote a 110-page book illustrated with photos about Spain and the group's activities. Sharing his excitement in the project, I helped prepare the manuscript for publication and paid the costs. Adventures of the Spanish Wildcats was received with acclaim at $10 a copy by both the travelers and others. I didn't mind my small financial loss. On a gray, damp December afternoon, Jack hesitantly revealed to his brother and me the explosive news that he would be baptized a Mormon in 2 days. We were speechless. Ed, a recent college graduate, was home that month for Christmas before leaving for Asia to study Chinese, teach English, and serve as a volunteer with a mainline Protestant church. Jack explained he'd planned to be baptized just before Christmas as a Christmas present. "A present for your family?" asked Dad, who had come home from his office at my request. "Well, I guess not. I guess it's just for me. It's too late now to change, though. People are bringing fancy food for a big reception after the Saturday service, which is rarely done. They like me at the college ward. Everybody's coming to my baptism." "And everybody knew but your family. You said you'd never turn Mormon, even though you have Mormon friends," said Dad. "I didn't want to hurt you. I was afraid to tell you. I love you. I needed you to help with my Spain book." "Remember all the evenings you flopped down on the couch beside me and we talked together," I reminisced. "We compared some Mormon and Protestant ideas, but not in depth, for you said you'd never join. If you told us you were serious about Mormonism, we could have had clergy scholars talk with you. Then you could have made an objective decision. You could still do it, Jack. Put off this baptism. If you examine all sides and then decide to go Mormon, we might give permission." "That's why I didn't tell you. I don't need permission. I'm 20 years old." Later, on his overseas mission, Jack discovered that nobody could be baptized or go on a mission without permission if living at home, dependent upon parents or husband. People in our city were aware, that Jack lived in our home with tuition, books, food, clothes, and car furnished by us. My husband refused to attend the baptism. You lied, and so did the other people who knew about this. If something important isn't told, it's the same as a lie. Be baptized when you've already been baptized and go to heaven for lying? But Jack's mother went to the baptism accompanied by Ed. The saints who greeted us said the crowd of 150 was large for one baptism. Everyone thinks so highly of Jack. They admire him so much, they said. As mainline Christians who see Christ's agony and death on Good Friday and his resurrection on Easter as the center of faith, Ed and I were surprised to hear Jack's conversion story. He was converted in a famous Catholic cathedral in Spain during the Good Friday Semana Santa, a young woman said. That cavernous cathedral was cold and remote compared to our Mormon warmth. We had no background to prepare us to witness a bloody Christ hanging on the cross in scenes that made the Catholics cry. A dead Christ, not a living one. Jack felt our closeness. We knew then he'd become a Mormon. Jack told us later, he'd said, if Jesus hadn't suffered and died on the cross, there would be no resurrection and no living Christ. When he protested to the students that his Protestant family would be very upset if he became a Mormon, they said, leave your parents and follow him. Another speaker commended his study of Mormonism. A classmate reported Jack had read the Book of Mormon, Doctrine and Covenants, Pearl of Great Price, and the Bible a number of times. When I asked the group during the attractive reception if study didn't mean that Jack should have also talked with his pastor of years and other clergy, they were surprised. Nobody had thought of it. Jack could have done that if he'd wanted to, they faltered. Because of his background and family, why didn't you advise it? Did you know he promised us just this fall he would not become a Mormon? Well, he shouldn't have done that, but he was afraid. He was also brave to stand against you for the faith. The salvation Jack will receive is for eternity, and that supersedes all else. We don't see it that way, Ed said. According to other families who had suffered the way we had, withholding information and waiting until the last minute to inform unsympathetic parents of a baptism were not unusual. Jack suggested we keep it quiet at our church about his new baptism. Then nobody in the flock who loved him would know, and he'd attend sometimes. In a year of his visible activity in the Mormon Warden Institute, no members of our church found out. Deciding not to tell Jack's Protestant grandmother and other relatives in faraway cities about his baptism, we hoped we could live harmoniously with him at home despite his change of religion. Then a year and a half later, I was spending 2 months 1,500 miles away fixing up and marketing my late parents' house, which I didn't want to sell, but my co-owner brother did. Jack had said he'd come and help me when school was out in June, and I'd made dinner dates for us with friends. My husband, living at home with Jack that spring, had noticed nothing out of the ordinary. Mail from Mormon sources hadn't been sent to our residence, but to Jack in care of the bishop. And no wonder. Jack telephoned me at the distant family house. I have to tell you something you won't like. I'm leaving in 2.5 weeks for a Mormon mission. What, I gasped, sinking to the floor. A friend of mine asked, did you get objective counseling for this? No, but all my friends have gone on missions. You must have applied. Yes, but I didn't think I'd be called so soon. I planned to help Mother at the family home, which I love too. After the headquarters letter came, I thought maybe I'd cancel the mission because I was really torn. But everyone expected me to go. I asked God what to do, and he said go. I was afraid to tell my family because I knew they'd be upset. Mom, I hear you crying. Please don't. I love you. Quickly, I left the family home and drove 1,500 miles over burning hot roads on the 4th of July weekend. Since I couldn't finish my work, I'd be forced to drive back later to the house that Jack, Ed, and I had treasured. Although Jack's friends knew he was going on the mission, he'd asked them to us, and they didn't. By the time his bishop brought him to my husband's office, the story had become a campus drama. The villain? Not our son, but that non-Mormon family Jack was leaving to follow the truth. Jack had saved very little money, so we wondered how he'd pay for the mission. Although parents customarily finance a child's mission, my husband said we wouldn't because of our principles. Everyone knew you wouldn't pay, said Jack. My friend's parents in the college ward will take care of everything. Jack asked us, as it is baptism, not to tell our church about his mission. I answered, I have to because we need their prayers. On a two sunny July Sunday morning, I stepped to the front of our congregation in a plain black dress. We all know that our Mormon friends are ecstatic to have a child go on a mission, I said. It's their lifelong dream. But it's not our dream to have our Jack go on a Mormon mission. But that's what he's going to do. He's leaving next week. His farewell service is this afternoon at the University Ward. Will some of you come and support us? Please pray for all of us. After church, stunned members hugged my husband and me in sympathy. He's our boy, too. He grew up here, and we love him. We were consoled that the retired executive minister of our church's three-state region, similar in position to a Mormon general authority, agreed to give a prayer at the farewell service. But Mormon leaders said no. I was allowed to speak because I was Jack's mother. My name wasn't on the printed program, where family members usually are listed as participants. Instead, there were, to me, outsiders, speakers from Jack's baptism, the bishop, and an 18-member choir of Jack's friends. Again, my husband did not attend. A missionary to save souls through deceit? This is our thanks for all we've done for him and for this community. He recalled that when students came to him saying they no longer believed the Mormon faith and asked if they should leave the church, he advised them not to. Don't tear apart your family, your background. Do the best you can at church for at least a couple of years, my husband had said. Why couldn't of others have told my son that, he exclaimed. Ed offered to fly home from Asia to help us in the crisis, but we didn't feel he should travel so far. Alone, except for members of my church, I walked down the aisle of the Mormon chapel to the pulpit. As Jack's mother, I share memories, I began. Our family has been involved in mission. My grandparents went abroad for life as missionaries. My clergyman grandfather translated the Bible from English into the people's language. My brother founded a social settlement center in a needy country and a community for refugees under our mission board. Our family, including Jack, were affiliate missionaries for a year in Asia. I related anecdotes about Jack's growing up as parents do at farewell, and the audience smiled. Then I changed my tone. May I close with a prayer prepared by the retired top executive of our church's region. Our God, whom we know as creator and sustainer of life and love, we thank you for the opportunity to serve, even as we acknowledge there are many ways of serving you. Help Jack to understand there are many avenues by which your people may come to know you and your way, I said firmly. Help us to avoid the arrogance of believing there's only one right approach to your loving care. Grant us open minds to learn more of your truth from whatever source. Grant Jack an open heart to receive all people of whatever race or creed as persons beloved by you. May we each hold to the integrity of our own beliefs, and may those beliefs be in accordance with the teachings of Jesus the Christ. Many of the 300 Mormons present told me they liked the prayer and understood how our family felt. After several months on his mission in a far land, Jack started to comprehend our feelings. He wrote that he loved us, thanked us for bringing him up as we did, apologized for the selfish way he treated us. His mission president counseled Jack that he and his associates were unkind in their actions toward us. He said, "Our family gave our son his values. We appreciate the teachings he has received in the home and his high standards. We know they came from his family," he wrote. "Despite the tears I have shed, we love our son deeply and appreciate many of his Mormon associates. He's our son and an integral part of our family. We enjoy the support of our congregation and other Protestants. We continue to be fully involved with our church work. My husband is state president of the Protestant Campus Ministry, which carries on the united work of 7 denominations at 9 higher education institutions. I am communication director of a 3-state ecumenical ministry. I was presented with the National Celebration of the Gifts of Women Award for Mission and Service by our denomination. Ed tells our church and community of his work with Protestant churches in several Asian countries when he visits us. If more Mormons would realize there are people other than themselves who devotedly believe in their church, their values, understanding could build between the faiths. If some would see that others do not rejoice to have a child become a Mormon and go on a mission, rapport could develop. Some Protestants fear that Mormons allow untruths in order to get converts. With the sharing of integrity, appreciation, kindness, and respect between people of different faiths, brotherhood could begin. Perhaps when he gains increased insight, our Jack may be a bridge with others toward fulfilling the needs of an aching world, that brotherhood may prevail." Thanks.
Our next speaker will be Donald L. Hebert, a native of Texas. He has lived, he and his wife raised a family in Utah, in the Ogden area. He holds a bachelor's degree from Lamar University in sociology and psychology, Master's of Theology from Southern Methodist University, with an emphasis, of course, in theology, and a Doctorate of Theology from Denver University, the Iliff School of Theology, with an emphasis in pastoral care and counseling. At present, he lives with his wife in South Ogden. His profession is a marriage and family therapist at St. Benedict's Hospital Outpatient Counseling Service, and he is the pastor of Christ Community Church in South Ogden. So his paper will be Pluralism in the Strenuous Mode, Donald Hebert.
I do appreciate the opportunity to present these thoughts, and I appreciate the personal nature of yours. These will not be quite so personal, but may be important. Can you hear me? Okay. I was once invited to share the honors of officiating a wedding in which there was to be myself, a Protestant pastor, and an LDS bishop. The bishop happened to be the uncle of the bride, and the groom's family were members of a Protestant church that I was serving at the time. Now, normally, I would have gone through the wedding rehearsal on the evening before the wedding. Go through every detail, make sure everybody knows what everyone is to do. In this case, I was informed that we would not need a rehearsal and that the bishop would fill me in on the details before the wedding. And so I came about an hour early so that we could go through those details. I was told at the time, we'll do that later. Well, I came back, and I was told, we'll do that later. I came back again. It was about 15 minutes prior to the wedding. I was beginning to be a little anxious. And I was told that I was to say a prayer at the end of the service that he would conduct. I was told by the bishop. I protested. I was invited by the family of the groom to share in the wedding, but there was no sharing to be done. My protest fell on deaf ears. And so we informed the family of the groom. They too protested. They wanted a shared wedding, but nothing happened with that. We were stunned as we stood there and listened to the bishop's response. His absolute refusal in sharing the wedding was justified by his thought, his comment. And with an air of pride, he looked at me and said, "We may be a minority in North Carolina, but we are a majority here, and this is the way it's going to be." This man's attitude was hard to tolerate, to say the least. But I should say it was no different in kind from that sixth grade teacher I remember when I was living in East Tennessee, who once excused me from the classroom so that all the other Protestant children could say their prayer, while I, a Catholic, could be excused from the room. Now, I don't know if I was to contaminate their prayer or something. We were one of three or four Catholic families in this little town. Everyone else seemed to be Protestant. It didn't feel so good being excused for their prayer. Nor was the bishop's behavior different in kind from our own Catholic priest in that same town, who withheld the privilege of Holy Communion from myself and my family and threatened to excommunicate us because my sister wanted to marry a Protestant boy and my mother and father wanted to attend the wedding in a Protestant church. Whether one is Mormon, Protestant, or Catholic has little to do with this kind of behavior the bishop displayed. This issue is not denominational. This issue is attitudinal. And when one comes to believe that he or she is privileged to know, to possess, and somehow to execute absolute truth, expressions of arrogance are usually not far behind. 5 decades ago, premier theologian Reinhold Niebuhr put it this way. He says, "Man is insecure and involved in natural contingency. He seeks to overcome his insecurity by a will to power which overreaches the limits of human creatureliness. Man is ignorant and involved in limitations of a finite mind, but he pretends that he is not limited. He assumes that he can gradually transcend infinite or finite limitations until his mind becomes identical with universal mind. All his intellectual and cultural pursuits and I might add, religious pursuits, therefore become infected with this sin of pride. Man's pride and will to power disturb the harmony of creation. Now, the Bible defines sin in just and moral terms. The religious dimension of man's rebellion against God is his sin. His effort to usurp or take the place, or may we say, become God, is his sin, his religious sin. The moral and social dimension of sin is injustice. The ego, which falsely makes itself the center of existence in its pride and will to power, inevitably subordinates other life to its will, and this does injustice to other life. The bishop's problem was not that he was Mormon or that he acted as if he was Mormon. His problem was that he was human, and just like you and just like me, he was unable or unwilling to recognize the limitations of the human condition. We do not and we cannot know in absolute terms. We live in a world that is open to an infinite variety of constructions, revision, and replacement of our interpretations of the world is an ongoing process. And yet, at any point in time, our mental construction system sets limits beyond which it is impossible for a person to perceive. In other words, we simply cannot go beyond ourselves in some ways. And since a person's psychological processes are channelized by the ways in which he or she construes or anticipates the events of this world, it is understandable that feelings of certainty, feelings and thoughts of exclusivity do come about. But to act on those feelings by isolating and exercising a single construction as if it is the only way to interpret the world can be and most often is dangerous. And aside, I would think that we have to look no farther than our world condition to see that once we perceive the world in one way and think that is the only way, conflict will result. Plurality is a matter of fact in this world. Plurality is obvious. We don't have to prove it. It exists. And to act as if our own view is the only view is what we could define an act of hostility. This kind of exclusive thinking is hostile because it seeks to force conformity. It seeks to force circumstances to confirm our own way of seeing things. If history teaches us anything at all, it teaches us that efforts to place the whole world under one view are bound to fail. For we humans are creatures who are made to think. We are hardwired, so to speak, to think. And no thinking person can ever accept a world thought out and given to us by someone else. Tradition, yes. Celebrate tradition, yes. Dogma, no. We are not meant to be ideologues. Each of us must make our own efforts at making sense of the world in the best way we know how. And if plurality results from our interpretations of the world we see and experience, can we not expect the same when it comes to the unseen world, the world of the spirit, the world of the nature and character of God. Now, lest this talk of a plural world lead you to believe that I am somehow advocating a philosophy of laissez-faire pluralism, I would quickly add that the world that seems to be open to alternative constructions is also a very real world. We humans are created to think, but we suffer grave consequences if we allow that all thinking is equally acceptable, for it is not. There are means of verification of our thought. And when it comes to matters of such importance as meeting our own needs as humans or finding meaning and purpose in this life of ours, we must opt for strenuous thought, thought that is open to testing and verification. We must not allow ourselves simply to drift into the kind of thought that meaning requires. And when it comes to our inevitable religious differences, I, for one, would opt for pluralism in the strenuous mode. When we talk about God, let us use language that is fully public and fully accountable. If we are to make any claim to public truth, let us define and clarify the basic rubrics that will make for intelligent discussion of our alternative views. To that end, I would briefly reiterate David Tracy's summary of a general set of rubrics that would invite Christian unity within the matter-of-fact diversity that we have. There are constants, whether we are Protestant, Jewish, Hindu, or Mormon, there are constants in our God talk. And the first constant among all those who would do theology or God talk is the appeal to tradition. All of us appeal to some tradition. All theologians are involved in interpretation, and therefore each of us who would talk about God are then responsible for developing and clarifying criteria of appropriateness. How do you come about the interpretation that you do make? How do you translate your tradition into this day and time? Do you do experience? Do you do it by philosophical argument? Do you do it by a traditional way of interpreting tradition? Do you do it by revelation? We are responsible for clarifying how we go about making tradition a reality. Maybe you think not. I think so. It is not important to simply make claims in the name of religion. It's not enough to do that. If we wish to live together in this world with some modicum of peace, we must be willing to give up the hostile, exclusive language that eliminates the possibility of dialogue. For dialogue depends on both the possibility of understanding. If I cannot understand you, we cannot talk. And the willingness to understand another position for its own sake in its own terms. If I am not willing to listen to your tradition in its own terms, then we cannot talk either. If we cannot make clear the means by which we're able to say what we say, we should not expect others to understand, much less accept our view. Likewise, if we're not willing to understand, why should they speak? A second constant in all religious talk is the definition of religious dimensions of our world situation. In other words, ethics. Religion is concerned with life, and religion is concerned with fundamental questions of the meaning of human existence. If we're to make claims about the meaning and value of life, we are responsible for clearly setting forth in public language the means by which we make those claims. It is not sufficient to justify a claim on the basis that the church teaches it, or God has told me so. If this justification is adequate for one church, then it is adequate for another church. This kind of justification inevitably leads to confrontational, exclusive language, which makes dialogue difficult, if not impossible. The world is open to interpretations beyond the either-or mode. And the world does not force us to lie in these Procrustean beds. These are beds of our own making. Pluralism in the strenuous mode calls us to move beyond the use of this logic of the excluded. Now, in both these constants, the use of tradition and the interpretation of our present situation, there is a question of what constitutes a public claim to truth. It is here that the nature of our plurality surfaces most clearly. It is one thing to acknowledge that each of us sees the world in a different way. It is quite another to open oneself to the possibility that truth may not be as exclusive as we have once imagined. Truth may not be singular. Truth may be plural. As William Oxtoby points out, when all is said and done, however much we appreciate other people and their traditions, don't we have to claim that we have the inside track and the clearest path? Doesn't the church's stance require us to regard the doctrines of others as false, or at least as less than fully true, and their piety as mistaken, or at least as less effective in leading to salvation than ours? We become so emotionally bound to our understandings of truth that it takes only a bit of open-mindedness to see that there are different ways in which truth can be understood and verified. I want to briefly just mention six ways we can look at truth. Those can be woven together and give us various combinations. There is propositional truth. Here, faith statements are made, and they're held to be cognitively and factually true, and they may be corroborated by reference to recognized authority. Now, let me give you an example. One might hold that the American Indians were direct descendants of the Hebrews. The truth of this belief is verified by reading the Book of Mormon, which in itself is a direct translation of the golden plates. That is a propositional truth. Now, we could say the same in every religion, and you have the same truth. Second kind of truth is coherent truth. Is the system coherent? Does it hold together? Does it make sense in relation to itself? If it does not, we have to question. Propositional truth, coherent truth, and developmental truth. Here, one religion may see itself as a sequential fulfillment of another. For example, Christians might argue that Christ is the fulfillment of Judaism. Jews would not argue that. We could obviously extrapolate from that. Pragmatic truth. One need look no farther than the results to get pragmatic truth. The truth is, what one does. Truth is known by its fruit. And fifth, existential truth. This, I think, touches on part of what Polly was talking about. The emphasis is not on a verifiable fact, but on the meaning of experience. Truth is truth for a person in their own experience. Well, just pray to the Lord, and if you get the answer, you will know the truth. Well, if it works for one, it works for all. And what if two people get contradictory words from the Lord? I don't mean this in any negative way, but it's just interesting that when Spencer Kimball received a revelation one day here in Salt Lake City relating to blacks in the priesthood, I was in Salt Lake City. You know, what if I had a revelation that would have said something a little different? Which one of us had the true revelation? It's hard to know. By the way, I didn't get a revelation that day. Truth, the sixth type of truth we might look at is truth beyond determination. This approach to truth has been used in the theological method via negativa, and it was used in classic arguments for the existence of God. We may not be able to demonstrate what God is, but we can say what God is not. As a dimension of God's nature, truth goes beyond conceptualization here. Tradition may point to the truth, but it does not contain it. Now, these approaches to truth can be added to, and we can move them around in various ways, and the list can be combined for various permutations. One might easily shift from one truth to another in an argument. If I'm talking with you, I'd like to know which one you're using so we can at least be in the same ballpark. It makes for fruitful dialogue. Now, if we are to approach pluralism in the strenuous mode, we must be willing to offer clarification of our methods of interpretation of our traditions, clarify our defining of religious situations, and clarify our understandings of how we determine truth. Accomplishing this would move us much closer to the kind of dialogue that pluralism does require. More than that, it might bring us a little closer to the love that Jesus commands. You might remember that in his last words to his disciples, he said, "And now I give you a new commandment, love one another. And as I have loved you, so you must love one another. And if you love one another, then everyone will know that you are my disciples." After all, what good is any program of evangelism? What good is any proposal of truth by any church if it does not produce the kind of people who are committed to keeping this commandment? Pluralism, in the strenuous mode, might be a small step in that direction.
I am pleased now to introduce Kandadai Sesachari, native of India, who is, I first met in 1962 as a Fulbright scholar at the University of Utah, where he took his PhD in English. He returned to India in 1965 and in 1969 came to the United States. Back to the United States with his wife, Neela Sesachari, who is with us today. And he joined the English faculty at Weber State College. Today he is chairman of that department. I will also say that his Mrs. Dr. Sesachari, Neela, is also a professor in that department. Dr. Sesachari will speak to us with this title, a Hindu's lament about the state of Mormon religious symbols. Dr. Seth Char.
Thank you, Levi. As Neil and I walked into the foyer, I saw Levi there in a white coat, and it's the first time I've seen him in anything like that. And he said he just recently bought that at a church rummage sale. And, this must have been an intuitive decision on Levi's part to wear white, because I'm going to be talking a little bit of that. I'm reminded of somebody like Elmer Gantry, who is on the Temperance Society, going doing different shows in the Midwest. He would always take the town drunk and put him there and talk about temperance and say, you know, if you don't, this is what you'll essentially become. And I wish Levi had introduced me also as the only non-Mormon president of the Association for Mormon Letters and one of its very best. So when Levi asked me to be here, I had been thinking of certain things. There was a period of about 3 or 4 years, so is it? Those who are short very often do not realize that they are so. There was a time when I wrote what I thought was fairly extensively on Mormon theology and literature, but I've drifted away from it to do something else. So this gave me an opportunity to come back to. And our daughter left on an internship to a law firm in India on a Harvard-based program this morning. One of the things she said to me, the last thing was, get that story out that you've written, which was not turned down, came back to me several years ago asking that I change the name of the bishop in the story, and the name of the bishop was Nibley. But great regard for Hugh Nibley and for his marvelous sense of humor and everything else, and I'd kept it. I didn't feel like changing the name. It's the story of a woman who went from one-piece garment to two-piece garment, and it literally changed her life in many ways. But but I think I'm going to. I told her, one of the last things I said is, I will get that out. My paper is called A Hindu's Lament About the State of Mormon Religious Symbol. And I want you folks to take me rather seriously, because I think it's in a state of grave danger of being subverted. Here is the paper. It was early October of 1984. Linda Newell and I found ourselves returning from San Francisco on the same late evening Delta flight. Linda Newell was in the Bay Area to promote her book on Emma Hale Smith, and I was there to attend a professional conference and visit my wife, Neela, who then was a visiting scholar at Stanford. As we boarded the flight, I sensed Linda go taut, as one would in the presence of authority. Instinctively, she smiled and proffered her greetings to a distinguished-looking passenger whom I readily recognized as one of the apostles of the Mormon Church. As I passed him, I noted that he was poring over some papers. He was clad in a high-priced black suit, or wore black stretch socks, and was shod in more than merely respectable black shoes. His face, like that of the Egyptian king in the Shelley sonnet, bespoke of authority. His tie was in place, knotted cleanly, as it neatly contoured itself against his unsoiled white shirt. The white shirt stood against the foil of the dark suit. He seemed to be in possession of himself as he obviously seemed to be in possession of Linda Newell's presence. He looked a veritable prince of the Mormon hierarchy. Two rows behind him, on the same side of the first-class section, sat another symbol of power. He too looked self-assured. He too was poring over some papers that were chock full of figures and numbers. He too was dressed in a dark suit. He too was clad in a white shirt that bore well-threaded stripes of royal blue. He too looked resplendent. He too radiated authority and control. What struck me then, as it had 1,000 times before, was the uncanny likeness between the two, that the elders of the Mormon Church bear a deliberately well-cultivated resemblance to the leaders of business and industry. It struck me, too, that the apostle of the Mormon Church exuded an aura of righteousness, of a strictness that seemed more regimented than natural, and of a sense of certitudes of the here and hereafter. He seemed to know who he was, where he was, and what he was. His two sartorial colors of black and white, beloved of the church, somehow seemed to symbolize the two domains of church activity. White stood for purity, transcendence, a life of the Spirit. It stood for the truth of the gospel and of an eternal dispensation under God. Similarly, the somber black, and very often dark colors do duty for black as well, stood for the things of the world, for material prosperity and acquisitions, of the life of the body, and of all the temptations and evil that it is heir to. But in all of this sartorial design, the black was not at odds with the white as in some Hawthorne tale, but they blended together, seemed to be in harmony with each other. Even as symbols, they did not seem to clash. One seemed to supplement the other, and somehow there seemed to subsist a union between the two. Ironically, for a religion, Mormonism has a penchant for turning life-giving symbols to mere concrete facts. The white shirt is just one such case and point where the larger metaphorical and spiritual implications of white have been crucified at the altar of what is temporarily expedient. Given the historic impulse of the church to control its activities and its members, it's not difficult to fathom the reasons why it chooses to fetter its symbols. Normally, symbols such as colors have a vital place in all cultures and religions. They, like other symbols, are visible and transparent symbols that shape and reshape religious texts with a thousand truths, bestowing immediacy to personal experiences. Symbols transport the human mind to realms beyond time and space, even as they illumine the text. The symbols perforce have to be transparent, as Joseph Campbell points out. Otherwise, they become parched and dry and are devoid of life. Symbols die when we turn them into artifacts of daily life. When religious symbols become things in themselves, religion is robbed of one of the most potent tools of accessing the meaning of spiritual experience.
Keep in mind the 20-minute duration. At this point, I go through one or two personal incidents in my life where I had a stake president who went as a mission president and returned recently, visiting my office, wanting to find out how I felt about Mormonism. And I gloated a little by saying people consider my wife and me as dryland Mormons. So he barged a little more intensely into the topic. But over a period of an hour and a half or so, he kept on flicking dust particles and off his white shirts. And another time, it's there, I've written it, another time Neela and I were invited by a South African Boer who ended up in Neela's class but followed us, became one of our members of the family, like married in the temple, and he invited us to come for the photographing session on the east grounds of the temple. By one of those quirks of things, we entered a little hole on the wall on the, is it on the state, not state, is it Main Street, and went down into a subterranean thing. And we were unchecked, and then I told Neela, you know, there's something wrong with this, because this is sacred ground, because I saw people flitting around in white. No. And Neela said, you know, if you're wrong in the place, surely somebody's going to tell us. And surely there was a person who led us out of the thing. It was a brief glimpse into the whiteness of Mormon experience. I have a theory here. White, as in a white shirt, does not brook of any soiling. It insists on being nothing but white. It expects to be fended off from all dirt and grime. Everything else in the world is its enemy. The white shirt, a symbol of other things white in Mormonism, inhibits the wearer from getting his or her hands dirty. People in white shirts shy away from dirt. I am certain that the gravedigger in Hamlet was not wearing white. Funeral parlor workers do not wear white until after the dearly beloved deceased have been made presentable for viewing. I can vouchsafe for that. Once I entered a funeral home for a viewing through a wrong door and ended up in its workroom to see some old grandmother's frazzled, wispy silver hair being blow-dried as she was resting on an elevated marble work platform. The person working on the body was in anything but white. I cite these incidents only to highlight the obvious, that the Mormon penchant for converting life-giving symbols trivializes opportunities for self-realization and forces the devout to react to life's many pains and agonies in standard ways. The freshness of reaction to the joys and pains of living is transformed into ritualistic reactions. Loss of the symbolic nature of language, for instance, leads to a loss of meaning. Instead of negotiating sacred texts, the brethren merely begin to live at the level of the popular Mormon myths. Eugene England, for example, points out in a recent Sunstone article that many Mormons swear by popular myths that directly contradict what Mormon scriptures and Mormon prophets actually hold forth. Another one points out, once again in Sunstone, points out that in organizational affairs, when goals are misperceived and misunderstood, organizational resources are misspent, and dysfunctional behaviors begin to manifest themselves. I'm going to edit here. I wholeheartedly agree that much of the activity in the Mormon Church, from ward level, primary, and mutual activities to the church-wide organized attempts at providing relief to victims of natural disaster, saps the spiritual energies of the faithful, and the lowering of the higher goals is directly the result of the Mormon impulse at concretization of its symbols. Let me revert to the point I am making about the color white. Mother Teresa and her Sisters of Charity also wear white. The white saris symbolize for them purity, simplicity, rectitude, charity, and Christian love. The whiteness of their saris is essentially a symbol of not what or as much as what they stand for. In a basic way, they stand in stead of Christ, who was the greatest healer of them all. Their saris are transparent symbols of the basic message of Christ. In bringing Christ's healing to the destitute, to the afflicted, including those who suffer from AIDS, to the starving and the diseased, they become the human agency of something bigger, greater, and nobler. The symbol of who they are, too, makes them loom larger for what they are larger than what they are in real life. It's no wonder that Mother Teresa's sari is begrimed with the dirt of Calcutta slums where she works, is bloodied by the bodily swords of the dying to whom she brings physical comfort and spiritual solace. For her, white is the tangible color of her beliefs and not some clothing that has to be protected from the dirt of those amidst whom she lives. For Mother Teresa, there are no barriers of any kind. For her, suffering has no color, no race, no religion, and no gender. Her Sisters of Charity work with AIDS victims in the New York City as solicitously as they do with abandoned children on the streets of Bombay. In contrast, the LDS Church has no place in its hearts for the homosexuals or the victims of AIDS. The suffering of Mormon families of AIDS victims is tellingly told, for instance, in Carol Lynn Pearson's book, Goodbye, I Love You, and Wayne Scow's Sunstone article, one of his recent Sunstone articles where he lost his son Brad to the AIDS disease. Somehow it seems strange to believe that Christ has no place in his heart for homosexuals. Wayne Scow says that his Mormon friends strongly believe that his son Brad who had died of AIDS was lost for eternity. Thus it is that Orson Scott Card has no compunction in inviting homosexuals to withdraw from the Mormon community if they cannot, I'm quoting, obey the rules that define that community. And he says, I again quote, if it happens that they never repent, then in the day of their grief, they cannot blame us for helping them deceive and destroy themselves. That is how we keep ourselves unspotted by the blood of this generation. This is a quote from Card. To remain unspotted by the blood of others seems to be a Mormon refrain that too many Mormons would subscribe to. I maintain that unless the Mormons learn to get their garments, shirts, dresses bloodied with the blood of the refuse of society, they will never produce a Mother Teresa in a millennium. I do not mean a good people or a caring people or a loving people. Mormons are all that. But I mean a Mother Teresa who does not approach sin selectively. To my mind, the concretization of symbols among the Mormons derives from three reasons. The first of them has to do with its anthropomorphic approach to God. All religions are anthropomorphic in some measure or the other, but Mormon imagination is too weighted down with too many certitudes. Even God is not immune from concrete characterizations. For instance, as Prophet Joseph Smith said down, God himself was once as we are now and is an exalted man and sits enthroned in yonder heavens. If you were to see him today, you would see him like a man in form, like yourself in all the person, image, and the very form of a man. So too are its concepts of the celestial kingdom and who belongs on the various levels of heavenly dispensation, and so too are its view of the eternal family, to mention only a few concrete details of the hereafter. Much of this concrete view is graphically rendered on the walls of the visitors' center in the Temple Square in downtown Salt Lake City. The lay guides that walk literally thousands of visitors to the center every week give a detailed description of the Mormon view of time and eternity in very concrete terms. All presentations at the centers are literally testimonies to the veracity of the Mormon view of truth. Herein may lie the Mormon penchant for concretization. If one can concretize God, that is, if one can dot the I's and cross the T's of what or who God is, then it pretty much stands to reason that we are at liberty to dot the I's and cross the T's of everything else in creation. The second reason why symbols get derailed in Mormonism lies in the fact of one of its strengths, its lay priesthood. Priesthood confers extraordinary powers on the males, for better or for worse. priestess bestow powers on the ordinary everyday male members to operate at the level of what turns out to be the ordinary, and then in turn, they in turn spin tales and myths that may not be in tune with their scriptures as with its by and large conservative male-dominated views. Because of their made-to-order myths are backed by the gift of the Holy Ghost, one of the articles of the faith, which is enshrined as an article of the faith, the Mormon males pretty much have a field day in putting in place whatever will pass muster. How else can one explain such blatant disregard for the word of wisdom under which now a good Mormon can almost eat or drink anything except coffee? The erstwhile taboo on Coke is now a remnant of memory unless it be enshrined in a standards policy at BYU. Also, how else can one explain the popular belief that sex is taboo except for replenishing the human race? I keep on. There's a third reason, give other instances, for the Mormon degeneration of symbols. The third reason for the Mormon denigration of symbols is directly tied to its doctrine of revelation. Ironically, the bedrock doctrine of revelation, which provides resilience and vitality to an ever-growing church, also plays into the hands of the members in remaking the church in their own accepted and acceptable political, economic, social, and cultural images. Elder Boyd K. Packer, of the Quorum of the Twelve, for instance, has said that the Vietnam War was lost by America because, I quote, the weakening of the moral fiber of America. He continued, some terrible things occurred in Vietnam. Our men had no stomach for it when they were doing it and could not get over it after they had done it. Many fought in Vietnam without the conviction that what they were doing had a fundamental moral purpose. Such statements coming from the Apostle of the Church only make the Church monolithic in its views and values. It gives very little freedom for the individual members to craft a satisfying spiritual and personal life. Revelation also undergirds the belief that practically everything that the Church or its members do is revelatory in spite of Prophet Joseph Smith's unequivocal statement that not everything he said had revelatory implications. He explained that only those statements that involved his role as a prophet were revelatory and not otherwise. But the substance of this dictum is lost on the membership who are too afraid to say or do anything that seems tantamount to disobeying a hierarchy that demands obedience, pure and simple. A revelation that once was the medium for restoring the church to its pristine mission is now popularly used to control the life and thoughts of a people. And its twin, testimony, which is rightfully public in its very nature, has become a tool to monitor who says what. I am told, for instance, that the temple recommend was withdrawn for a time from a highly regarded professional for saying publicly, this is very recently, for saying publicly that the recently instituted changes in the endowment ceremonies were a step in the right direction. I have known writer friends who were blacklisted or reprimanded or were asked to drop their association with intellectually thriving professional organizations. When I was president of the Association for Mormon Letters, one of the members of the board one day came and reported that he had been asked by his supervisor to resign the membership because he saw a conflict with what he was doing within the church and his membership of the association. Too many of those instances. The voices are either muffled or stifled. As I see them, these people are forced to live quiet lives and often become invisible members within the church and sometimes even within their own families. There is undoubtedly an all-pervasive instinct within the church to remake its symbols, myths, and perceptions to fit a mold that is burnished bright with middle-class views and values. Quite obviously, there is something at the heart of Mormonism that has made it preeminently successful. By their dedication, will, and faith, by their toil and sweat and blood, successive generations of Mormons have made the dreams of their prophets come true. I think Mormonism works because there is something good and noble at its core. It responds to human hunger for some blueprint of salvation. Its strength derives from its own story, which parallels the basic Christ story. It has its crucifixion and its exodus. Its battles are of an epic nature, and the story of its people truly uplifting. It has its life-giving symbols, myths, rituals, and folklore. But here is the catch. When the symbols and myths of a religion lose their ability to invoke different shades and colors of intuitive meanings, then the faithful will also die to the symbols. When I see five-year-olds dressed in white shirts and black ties trailing behind their similarly attired fathers on way to Sunday ward meetings, I feel the time has come for the Mormons to revivify their symbols and myths. Remember the two personages Linda and I saw on our homeward flight from San Francisco? I had said there was an uncanny resemblance between the apostle of the church and the leader of the American business. When Mormon symbols merely become crass artifacts of everyday life to promote the business of Mormon living, rather than inspire them to a spiritual quest, the church would have become a computer-driven organization fully cast on the mold of American business, which it so resembles. More than the Mormons seem to realize, the future and the fortunes of Mormonism are inextricably linked to its symbol. What you do unto your symbols, the symbols will do unto you.
We have 10 minutes for questions. Would you like to ask a question, please? Mary, please respond. You better repeat your questions one at a time repeat the question into the mic so we get it on the tape.
Oh, I'm not sure I can repeat the whole question. Can you repeat it all, Levi?
The first question was: Did you share your feelings with Latter-day Saints, any Mormons? Did you let them know how you were feeling?
I didn't do it too much. I shared it with people in my own church and other Protestants. When I talked with Mormons, I did a little, and different people would say, "Well, if the same thing happened to me and the opposite, you know, I would feel bad too." But the reason I really got into writing this and doing work in this field was people would still say to me, the Mormons, and of course they thought it was wonderful he'd gone on the mission. Of course they did. I understood that. They didn't seem to realize that perhaps I didn't, because I had a different background, and I would try to mention it a little bit, but I didn't go into it a lot. And when people would say to me, nice things about my son, well, my son is very nice, there's no doubt about it, I would just nod and say thank you. I felt it was difficult to explain, but I'd like to explain it. Okay, and I did.
Okay.
The second question?
Did you know that's probably why we're here as well?
That's wonderful. I'm very happy that Sunstone is here. I haven't been before. I went to a number of your sessions over the last couple of days, And I think it's marvelous, just wonderful to me that there's a group here that's open and interested and caring and that one can say things to. I commend you very much, Sunstone. Yes.
Okay, another question? Please.
Okay. The question was how Don Hebert felt toward the Mormon bishop following that situation.
I didn't generalize. I figured that this man had some things to learn in his own life, as I do. So.
Of Mormon friends did say this to us because we are friendly with a number of Mormon families, parents especially of my children's friends. My son has just come back, and I'm being careful what I say about him in a group like this. I wouldn't like to see any of it in the press, so I'm not going to say more.
We'll stand adjourned then. Thank you for your attendance.